From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. The White House is invoking executive privilege to potentially block release of the unredacted Mueller report. The announcement came as the House Judiciary Committee convened to consider holding Attorney General Bill Barr in contempt of Congress after not releasing the full report. We'll look at where the standoff's likely to lead right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Terrific to have you with us today. Imagine you're a young musician looking to break out from the crowd of talented performers in L.A. You find out mid-set that your idol is in the audience at the restaurant where you're performing. How would you handle that? What if your idol asked to perform with you on the spot? That happened a few nights ago to a local guitarist playing a gig at a Westwood restaurant. He'll join us to tell his story next hour, and we'll open up the phones for you to tell your story. If you are an artist of any type who ran into your idol and had some sort of an inspiring or engaging moment with the person that you've admired for many years, that comes up next hour on Air Talk. But first, the White House is invoking executive privilege over the unredacted Mueller report. As you just heard on NPR News, House Judiciary Committee's Democratic majority demanded that they receive complete unredacted copies of the report. The president responded this morning, just as the committee was preparing to debate, holding Attorney General Bill Barr in contempt of Congress for not handing over the complete report. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said the executive privilege action is a response to Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler's blatant abuse of power. And she said neither the White House nor Attorney General Barr will comply with Chairman Nadler's unlawful and reckless demands. Nadler said earlier the administration's refusal to provide the unredacted report presents a constitutional crisis, leaving the committee with no choice but to pursue a contempt vote against Barr. That vote is taking place momentarily, and we'll bring you the results of that. But where does the impasse leave us? Joining us is is Harry Litman, former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department under President Clinton, and professor of constitutional law at both UCLA and UC San Diego. Professor Litman, thank you for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, let's kind of back up for a moment. What is the legal platform for which Congress can demand the unredacted report? Because my understanding is, unlike the Starr report of years back, this report was prepared to go through the Department of Justice. So, what is the legal framework that Congress has to get this full report?
So the legal framework is much the same as Starr. That is, the Starr report was given over under an exception to the grand jury rules before impeachment proceedings were started in Congress as a way for Congress to consider it. That same exception would apply here. That's the platform, and that's why they're asking for unredacted materials. The riposte today from the White House is, hey, there's going to be some executive privilege materials in there. We are not, it's a nuance, but they didn't exactly assert executive privilege. They asserted protective executive privilege, a special sort of tweener legal category where they put an umbrella over everything so they can decide whether to fully assert executive privilege and over what. And that's where things stand right now.
Now, is there any sort of a time frame for that? Or if the White House just didn't act on this and make a final determination of what they were holding privileged and what not, would then a court potentially have to step in and say, look, you've had long enough to make that determination. You've got to release the whole thing? Or how would that issue be addressed?
Yeah. So in the first instance, it would be with Congress. So, yes, Congress could, and sounds like it will, right away say, enough of your dithering, we're going straight to court. But if when they go to court, they're going to be on a weaker footing when the Department of Justice can turn around and say, hey, we were negotiating in good faith and they pulled the trigger here, you know, either send us back or that's a good reason not to grant their subpoena. So their legal basis is sort of unchanged, but the tactical or strategic basis would be changed by a quick move on their part.
We're talking with Professor Harry Litman of UCLA and UC San Diego, former U.S. attorney. Also with us, professor at Pepperdine University School of Law, Barry McDonald. Professor, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts on, you know, when you've got a separation of power dispute here between two branches of government, how do the courts typically look at this being the third branch?
Well, the courts are going to try to, you know, do their best to force both the executive branch and Congress to reach some sort of reasonable compromise here that, that serves the legitimate interests of both branches. So Congress is, you know, trying to investigate further alleged obstruction of justice by President Trump. And, you know, wants a lot of this more detailed information in order to do that. And that is a legitimate task of Congress. President Trump or the Justice Department is going to assert that, you know, revealing some of this information will either violate some grand jury laws or will compromise law enforcement sources or will compromise perhaps national security interests in some ways. But I think that in the end, the judge is going to, you know, try to figure out what are sort of the legitimate interests that, that the executive branch has in concealing certain information. But all in mind, keeping in mind that Congress does have legitimate legislative oversight powers over all of the federal government. And so I think there's going to be a presumption in favor of disclosure unless the executive can prove that there's really good reasons to withhold the information.
Well, and is this really an issue about in sharing information that might be compromising to national security if it became public, the issue as to whether the Judiciary Committee or Intelligence Committee, wherever looks at that, as to whether they would keep that confidential as they do with the other kinds of classified material that's shared with them, or whether for political purposes they would leak that so that it would be widely known and potentially compromise national security. So are courts going to be comfortable making that call as to the confidence level in members of Congress to keep items confidential?
Knowing how Capitol Hill works, I don't think courts are going to place a lot of faith in assurances by Congress people that they're going to keep these things absolutely confidential. So I think that the court is going to ask itself, you know, if this did get leaked, how damaging could it be? And if it thinks it's going to be very damaging, then I don't think it's going to order the release. On the other hand, if you know, we're talking about sort of vague, unsubstantiated threats of harm, I think then the court might well order release.
We're talking with Barry McDonald, Pepperdine University law professor. Also with us from the Cato Institute's Robert Levy Center for Constitutional Studies, research fellow William Yateman. Thank you, sir, for being with us. Your thoughts on how this impasse is likely to play out through the courts?
I echo the prior commentators and the professors' the comments. It's sort of impossible to tell. It's prognosticating Article III court outcomes to begin with is a fool's errand, but especially so here where the legal test at issue is sort of a weighing test, the president's claims against the public interest of disclosure, and indeed keeping in mind this presumption in favor of disclosure for congressional legitimate legislative purposes as decided by Congress. So I would think it's difficult, it is difficult to predict sort of the outcome in the courts. That said, I do think history suggest what the prior professor spoke to, which is the court's going to do everything in its power to try to get the sides to come together and negotiate an outcome short of a legal order that, you know, requires them to do something. that is the historically preferred resolution here.
And how is executive privilege typically invoked? Because I've thought of it as things having to do with how an administration itself operates and the president having freedom in the kinds of conversations that he has with members of his cabinet. In a case like this, is executive privilege an appropriate banner under which to put national security issues or criminal investigative matters that could be compromised?
There's two categories, generally speaking, of privilege invoked by the executive, and one is presidential communications, and the other is sort of this all-purpose deliberative privilege, you know, which was of the sort you spoke of, that of people working freely and communicating freely and the free exchange of ideas. It's, as the Professor Littman spoke to at the outset, we don't yet know the extent to which this administration is going to claim executive privilege. So it's difficult to parse that question. However, it is, you know, from a common sense lens, it is difficult to imagine that any life or death, war-related, national security-related, diplomacy-related secrets or you know, privileged information would lie therein of the unredacted report. But that said, they haven't made the claim yet, so we don't know exactly what they are arguing.
All right. William Yeatman of the Cato Institute in Washington joining us. And Professor Littman, I know you have to run a busy time at your schools, but we appreciate your being with us and sharing your thoughts. Thank you. We'll continue with Barry McDonald and William Yeatman with us on Air Talk, looking at the issues that are raised. If you have questions for them about the law, how this is going to go in the courts to try and resolve the impasse, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Just let us know what questions you have. We'll bring them up over the course of our conversation on this issue. Let me go back to Barry McDonald of Pepperdine University. We have any sort of precedent for an impasse like this?
Well, there is some precedent, mainly involving, you know, Justice Department officials of various administrations where Congress has sought particular information and the executive has declined to cooperate. And then, of course, it sort of followed the pattern that we're talking about here. If you know, in the end, the executive refuses to give up any information, Congress will go to court, and some cases have reached the United States Supreme Court, and you know they're not numerous, but so there's not a ton of law out there because a lot of these issues do get resolved through compromise between the branches, but the law that is out there, you know, is pretty clear that the president is not above the law, that Congress is the primary lawgiver in our system of democratic governance, that Congress, you know, legitimately needs information in order to make sure that, you know, it passes good, wise laws and to make sure that there's no corruption by officials in the other branches. And so, again, I think the presumption is going to be with Congress because it is acting in its proper legislative role here. And it's going to be up to the executive to, you know, show really good reason why they can't reveal certain information.
Now, given the conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, is it possible that this high court, if this case were to reach them, would give the benefit of the doubt to the chief executive over Congress, despite, you know, the analysis you've just provided?
Well, I think that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be extremely sensitive to public perceptions here, that it is acting as sort of a legitimate interpreter and enforcer of the law, and it is above any sort of partisan considerations here. especially Chief Justice Roberts, who would sort of cast the critical fifth vote, perhaps, in many of these issues. And so I think that, the Supreme Court is going to, being the conservative wing, even sort of, argues that we need to interpret the Constitution in light of our historical understandings, in light of the text of the Constitution itself. And so, the conservatives even recognize that in our system, the framers set it up where Congress was the main engine of our democracy. And so even the conservatives are going to be coming from the perspective that Congress does have legitimate legislative oversight concerns here. So I don't think that, the Supreme Court is going to, be biased in favor of Trump. I think they're going to go out of their way to try to apply the law objectively in these cases.
We're talking with Barry McDonald, Pepperdine University law professor, William Yateman from the Cato Institute in Washington, the libertarian-minded Cato Institute. William Yateman, what kind of a time frame could we potentially be looking at here? Might this end up being moot if this isn't resolved by the next election?
Oh, my good Lord. I expect there would either be a negotiated result or by then. I mean, good Lord, what is that, a year and a half from
now?
The sort of time frame, even in the scenarios that don't implicate separation of powers like this, but when agencies have to act, a year and a half is the sort of time frame when a courts would spur action.
So they're going to accelerate the whole process to resolve this. And could some of the things the Trump administration has wanted decided, it's made a plea directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I wonder, could that happen here? We're sort of the federal courts below the Supreme Court has jumped over, goes straight to the high court.
There are judicial mechanisms to speed up controversies and the appeals thereof. I don't think the Supreme Court could ever exercise original, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Professor McDonald, but I don't think it would ever exercise original jurisdiction over this controversy. So, the wheels of justice are slow, but there are mechanisms to speed it up. For example, the Trump decisions with respect to the travel bans and whatnot, those were litigated on a much faster schedule than your normal controversy before an Article III court. I would expect, notwithstanding the president's pleas for direct Supreme Court action, that would not occur. And again, please correct me if I'm wrong, Professor McDonald, but that notwithstanding the slow wheels of justice, that there are mechanisms for high priority cases to speed it up.
All right, Barry McDonald, what do you think?
Certainly there are those mechanisms where they have taken appeals directly from lower district courts and bypass the Intermediate Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. And that may happen here, but there's going to be a lot of fact-finding and factual issues that have to be resolved. So if the Trump administration were going to try to bypass that and just get the Supreme Court to say, shut down these investigations altogether, I don't think there's any sort of chance that that could happen. I think the Supreme Court's going to recognize that it's going to need a detailed factual record on these claimed assertions of harm from revealing certain information. And so I think that the Supreme Court's going to let that record develop. I think the district court's going to move fast. It's possible that after the district court holds its hearings and makes its finding of fact, that the Supreme Court could step in and bypass the Court of Appeals at that point. But even there, the Supreme Court often likes to have, the lower courts take a hard look at issues before it takes a look in its sort of capacity as the final arbiter of these issues.
We're talking with law professor Barry McDonald of Pepperdine University, right here in Malibu, William Yateman at the Cato Institute in Washington, where he's a research fellow at Cato at the Levy Center for Constitutional Studies. We're talking about the impasse between the House Judiciary Committee and President Trump. The Judiciary Committee, under its chairman, Jerry Nadler, demanding a complete unredacted version of the Mueller report. In fact, the committee's expected within the hour to take a vote on whether to hold the Attorney General Bill Barr in contempt of Congress for refusing to release the unmasked report. President Trump's administration earlier today announced the invocation of protective executive privilege. Professor Littman of UCLA talking about that, which is not quite the same as a full-blown executive privilege, but sort of reserving the right to invoke executive privilege to keep the unredacted Mueller report out of the hands of Congress. So that's where we stand. We're at the impasse right now. And as that vote is being readied by the Judiciary Committee of the House, we are joined by Tamara Keith, NPR's White House correspondent and co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. Tamara, thanks for being with us as we await this vote from the Judiciary Committee. First of all, is there any doubt as to what that vote is going to be on contempt of Congress?
Well, Democrats have the majority on that committee, so I don't think there really is that much of a doubt at all.
And then what comes next?
What does come next? This is sort of this slow speed collision between the executive branch and the judicial branch. This is one skirmish in that, but it is going to continue. And, you know, Congress, beyond a contempt vote, doesn't have a lot of levers here. They technically could try to arrest the Attorney General, but he has his own protective detail. And so, there just really aren't a lot of practical options for Congress to punish the Attorney General aside from contempt.
Yeah, I know that we had earlier case. Eric Holder was held in contempt over the Fast and Furious gun investigation, but I don't recall that anything ever came out of that.
Well, yeah, you can actually Congress could refer it to the Justice Department for possible criminal charges. But guess who's in charge of the Justice Department? The Attorney General, much in the same way that Attorney General Eric Holder wasn't going to punish himself back when Republicans were in control of Congress.
So that's where we stand now. With the Trump, the White House issuing this protective executive order, what executive privilege? Have they said anything more about what the next step for them would be as to describing the justification for this, or as to whether they would go the full route of invoking executive privilege?
We haven't gotten a lot of details from them. The short of it is that they're basically done. They feel like the Mueller report, Mueller did this long investigation, put out this report. People should read it if they want to, is sort of the White House message there, the redacted report, of course. And they say that Attorney General Barr is just trying to uphold the law, that they believe congressional Democrats are being unreasonable in trying to get him to give members of Congress an unredacted version of the report that would include grand jury materials that you aren't supposed to release, that are supposed to remain secret. And so the White House is saying that, Congress wants the Attorney General to break the law, and the Attorney General is merely upholding the rule of law. I think the most likely outcome at some point, and I don't know whether it will be this fight or a fight about any number of other documents or testimony that House Democrats are trying to get, but at some point, this is probably going to end up in court, and you're going to end up with the judicial branch trying to mediate a disagreement between, or decide a disagreement between, the Article I and Article II branches.
Not to take advantage of you coming on at very late notice to join me, but I wonder, could I also ask you about the president's response to the New York Times piece disclosing 10 years of the president's tax returns for his businesses showing a billion-dollar cumulative loss there? How's the president responded to that?
Well, the president has tweeted in response to it. No surprise there that he might come back with a tweet. And essentially what he said in that tweet was, hey, this is like the way you do business. It's the way I was doing business back then. And you mark all these losses because then you can write it off on your taxes is basically his message. The truth of it is that that failing has been a part of President Trump's sort of narrative that he tells about himself, it wasn't as bad as the Times makes it clear. But President Trump has always talked about being down on his luck, the real estate crash, and then coming back like a phoenix. So, the president is putting his own spin on it as he long has.
All right, Tamara, thanks so much. Really appreciate your coming on and updating us.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thanks, Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent, co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. Also want to thank our constitutional scholars with us, Barry McDonald of Pepperdine University, where he's the law professor, and William Yateman of the libertarian-minded Cato Institute in Washington, where he's a research fellow. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We are awaiting that vote, by the way, of the House Judiciary Committee over holding the Attorney General in contempt of Congress. We will alert you just as soon as we have the results of that vote. They're in a procedural vote right now on Capitol Hill. Earlier this week, Jill Biden published her new book and started doing rounds of interviews. She is an integral part of her husband's campaign to win the Democratic nomination for president. Joe Biden has spoken often about the importance of his wife to him personally and to his ideas. There have also been a number of other candidates who have spoken a great deal about their spouses. Chasen Buttigieg, the spouse of Pete Buttigieg, has been a presence on social media, has attended events with him, and they've spoken quite a bit about their marriage and what that means to Buttigieg's candidacy. So we're going to look back at political spouses over the years, the positive and negative roles that they played, or sometimes just the absence in campaigns, and particularly what that means for the 20-plus Democratic candidates for the nomination right now. Joining us to talk about it is Emily Heil, Washington Post reporter, who covers the First Lady and has been watching the spouses on the campaign trail. Emily, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So which candidates are really using their spouses as an important adjunct to their candidacies?
Well, you've mentioned two of them. I would say Chasen Buttigieg has really been a central part of his husband's campaign. And Jill Biden, too, has been an integral part of her husband's campaign. And I think both of them sort of speak to the narrative that their spouse is creating about themselves. And, you know, I think that the spouse is always this a character witness on behalf of the candidate. And people look to them to say, you know, what do you know about, why is you're with this person? You're the ultimate character witness. You can tell us things about this person. And I think that Chasen Buttigieg in particular he's very popular on social media. He runs the social media handles for their dogs. He's really been part of the conversation and gave a really great interview for a fantastic profile that one of my colleagues published just last week, and telling his story, which is now part of his husband's story, and getting people to get to know their husbands, and that's part of the job of being a first spouse or being a spouse on the campaign trail, for sure.
Well, and if he translates dog language, that's an incredibly valuable. We would all like to have that.
Right, Melania Trump speaks five languages. Who
knew? Yeah, but dog is the hardest, so that's great. We're talking with Emily Heil, Washington Post reporter, about the spouses and how much they're integrated into the campaign or not. You know, one of the things you're speaking of, Emily, is sort of the ability to of a spouse to pull back the curtain a little bit and to give us a better read on the priorities, on the values of that they hold, because what you see in the spouse tells you a lot about what they value. Because if it's a high intellect spouse, a high achieving spouse, maybe the spouse is more, someone who's not as much a high profile figure. Well, that tells you the candidate, they're not necessarily looking at the person they partner with is, whose public reputation is necessarily going to aid their public life, but they're looking at someone, maybe more behind the scenes connection for them. I think all of this is revealing of values and priorities in a candidate. But your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. And it also, I think candidates can use their spouses too as ways, as sort of, they always call the wife, and it's usually the wife, the secret weapon, right? That's the big cliche for political spouses. And what they can do is they can sort of fill in things. Often it's considered a softening effect, right? Usually it's the husband who's hard charging, and the spouse, the wife, is seen as sort of softening and putting a human side on someone. You think of someone like Mitt Romney, who often came off as awkward or cold, but his wife was thought to have that sort of humanizing effect for him. Think about Elizabeth Warren. Her husband, Bruce Mann, appears often on her social media feeds, and by her side, she's had this criticism that's dogged her. How likable is she? How how cold is she? And he's in some ways providing this very traditionally gendered role of being the spouse that makes the candidate look more human. They're always showing up on the social media feed with the husband and the dog. Here, and he was in that famous beer video that she posted. So he's playing what has been a very traditionally female role.
Emily Heil, Washington Post reporter. This makes me think of the documentary RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Obviously, she's not holding elective office, but her husband features prominently in that, and you really see how their relationship really benefited her ability to move up in the courts and to do her job. We'll continue our conversation after a live update from Hetty Lynn Herdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're doing well. If you were looking to get an Uber or Lyft ride this morning, you might have found it more difficult than usual. Some of the drivers are striking today. And coming up next hour, we're going to get a live report from LAX, which is the center of where that job action is taking place in Southern California. We'll also find out what's happening up at Uber headquarters up in Silicon Valley. And we'll open up the phones to drivers to talk about what they're seeking from Uber and Lyft and whether that's realistic within the financial framework of the company. Because, of course, a lot of the appeal is that it's so much less expensive to use those ride-hailing services than to take traditional taxis. Can drivers make significantly more hourly income and not end up hurting the platform itself and its competitive advantage it has currently? We'll talk about that. Right now, our focus is on the spouses of political candidates and whether they can actually boost the candidates or in some cases be harmful either by their absence or by negatives that could attach to them. In addition to Emily Heil of The Washington Post, we have with us from Princeton University, lecturer in politics and public affairs, Lauren Wright, author of On Behalf of the President, Presidential Spouses and White House Communication Strategy Today. Ms. Wright, thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us. Let's talk about the ways in which spouses could perhaps hurt a campaign. Are there examples of that where they've actually dragged down a campaign?
Hi, Larry. Great to be with you. And you couldn't have a better guest than Emily. We've talked about these topics a lot in recent months. You know, I have not found evidence in my extensive research that the absence of a spouse hurts a campaign. However, I think it's such a benefit and a boon to a campaign to have an active, involved spouse who's in lockstep communication strategy with the candidate, that not deploying them is sort of, it's almost political malpractice. You know, they are the single best and most effective messenger that you could possibly have on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I think of Barack Obama. Had he been single, or had a spouse who didn't connect as much with the public as Michelle, that would have hurt him. I think the fact that she is such a popular figure was a boon to him.
It was, absolutely. And, you know, spouses sometimes can be fiercely independent. Michelle Obama was certainly that way when she started out on the campaign trail. Melania Trump is very much that way. But what happens if you're willing to help, if you say to yourself, I'm going to do anything I can to push this campaign forward, you know, if you make a mistake, and that this is why it's so important that Jill Biden and Chasen Buttigieg are so involved early on, is because if you make a mistake now, you have time to correct it. You have time to staff up and get a support system and a messaging system behind you, and you learn and you do better. It's not easy work to be on the campaign trail with the media following you day in and day out. So the early involvement, the more involvement, the better. And Michelle Obama was a great example of that in 2008.
We're talking with Lauren Wright of Princeton University, also with us from Boston University, Associate Professor of Communication, Tammy Vigil. She's author of Moms in Chief, The Rhetoric of Republican Motherhood and the Spouses of Presidential Nominees. Professor Vigil, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. A lovely conversation you're having.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the absence of a spouse. You know, for example, Kamala Harris, her husband, who works in Southern California, hasn't been a particularly visible part of her campaign as she's been out. Would it be helpful potentially to have him by her side or a bigger part of her campaign?
I think there's a bit of a tricky gender question that now comes into play, because you want to be really careful thinking about the sort of male representation versus the female representation. Historically speaking, we're obviously very used to the wives of candidates being active in a very particular kind of way. Now that we have so many men and husbands that are our potential spouses in support, that role becomes a bit trickier for women, because you want to be careful not to have them dominate the conversation, and you want to be careful what kind of role they play, because you can really play up some of the potential questions about female leadership and what that actually means.
And I guess I'm curious about that, because the women who are running for the Democratic nomination are all, you know, very strong personalities. They're very, and I guess it seems odd to me that somehow a husband would undermine that, given the presence of these particular women.
Well, I think all you have to do is look back to 2016 and looking at the strong presence of Bill Clinton and some of the things that he did, that in trying to soften Hillary's persona, her public persona, he actually sort of undercut some of her presidential leadership traits, and he accentuated aspects of her that then opened her up to critique, which I think was problematic. And I think that's possibly why some of the strong female candidates that we have out now might be trying to sort of keep their husbands a little quieter, or let things shake out a little bit more. It's not unusual for candidates' spouses to be a little bit quieter in the earlier stages before the actual primaries kind of come out, the primaries really begin in earnest.
That's interesting. So you think Bill Clinton actually undermined Hillary Clinton's candidacy? Lauren Wright of Princeton University, I would have thought that Bill Clinton was beneficial to some extent, but what do you think?
He was beneficial to some extent, and, you know, the gender dynamics are absolutely there, and they're complicated, and we do have to acknowledge that in American politics, we equate political prowess and qualifications with masculinity, and we do not do the same thing with femininity. And so these candidates have to, the female candidates have to walk a very tight rope, and that's certainly a challenge. But I actually ran some survey experiments specifically on the topic of Bill Clinton's effect on Hillary Clinton's image back in 2016, and what I found was that among Republican men, he helped her, and specifically when they appeared side by side, he helped her. So that might be a little bit of the softening, you know. Sometimes it can help to have a male presence if you're a candidate like Hillary Clinton, or it could help see a different side of her. But of course, these things are different with every single couple and different in every time frame, and they play out very differently depending on the person.
Well, and you know, all of the Democratic candidates, all of the women that are running this time, you know, they were not first ladies. So there's nothing that you would point to in their husband that would say, oh, that benefited them as they started their political careers. Hillary Clinton, you know, despite all of her academic and legal work before becoming first lady, it undeniably being first lady was a huge boost to her. So, but these candidates, they don't have to deal with that issue. So how different is that, Lauren?
That's a great point. You know, it's a tricky combination because spouses on the campaign trail help when they reinforce the message. They help when they fill in these perceived personality gaps that we've been talking about. And they help when they fundraise. And in order to be an effective fundraiser, you have to be known. You have to introduce yourself to the public and to supporters. So that's probably part of the calculation a lot of these candidates are making, because the closest person to you who can vouch for your character, who can vouch for your leadership capabilities, that's your spouse. It's the person that you've spent your life with. I would also note that some gender dynamics, thankfully, are changing. You know, if you think about John Bessler, Amy Klobuchar's husband, and Jonathan Gillibrand, Kirsten Gillibrand's husband, they've been very involved in the Senate spouses group. Amy Klobuchar tells a funny story about seeing her husband walking around Capitol Hill, and she wasn't expecting to see him. And she said, "Hey, honey, where are you going?" or something of the effect to that. And he said, "I'm going to Jim Webb's wife's baby shower. Of course, you know, this is part of what I do." So I do think as time goes on, expectations of these spouses will change. And part of that is the gender dynamic.
All right. We'll continue our conversation with Lauren Wright, Tammy Vigil, and Emily Heil, all of them expertise on the experiences of political spouses, what they're able to bring to a campaign, what the absence of that political spouse, candidate spouse might mean. We'll talk about that and take your calls at 866-893-KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Next hour on Air Talk, the strike today, in which some drivers for Uber and Lyft are participating. We'll hear from drivers about what they want from those companies and whether what they want fits into the overall economics of the ride-hailing services. That's coming up on Air Talk. Also, we'll talk with an L.A.-based musician who grew up in Orange County, who was performing on guitar Friday night, a gig at a Westwood restaurant. And his musical idol happened to be in the restaurant having dinner and asked if he could perform with a young guitarist. Well, that guitarist will be with us in the second hour to talk about that surreal experience of having someone you grew up admiring wanting to perform with you and how that's affected his artistry. That's coming up in our second hour of Air Talk. Right now, it's candidate spouses, what role they ideally play, how they've historically benefited candidates, or if the spouse is absent, whether that is at all a detriment to the candidate. You have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We have listener James taking issue with the fact that we spend time talking about candidate spouses. I could not disagree more. I think a spouse tells you so much about a candidate and what he or she values. I think you learn so much by looking at them. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a very powerful first lady, a Nancy Reagan, let's say, but even a spouse who's more in the background can give you a sense of the values of you know, candidate sort of sees in him or herself in the world. I think it's quite a revelation. I welcome your questions. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Now, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker is dating a big actress, Rosario Dawson, and she's been at campaign events and the like. Emily Heil, the Washington Post reporter, what's your sense of how that's playing before crowds, having such a high-profile actor along with the candidate?
Well, she hasn't done too much with him yet for official campaign events. She said that she's, might do more later. She's got some filming to be done, but she might get more involved. It'll be interesting to watch how that plays out. Certainly, he has not shied away from talking about her. He talks about her in interviews all the time, and it inevitably generates the sort of cute, stories and coverage and, how they met and, cute stories that he tells about what he, how they communicate long distance, while she's working and he's in Washington. So, it's been nothing but positive for him so far. I think there might be some, inevitable backlash on, well, is it too much celebrity? But she's incredibly well-spoken, well-positioned, passionate about issues, has been an activist for a long time. So she has a profile that's not just, Hollywood celebrity, pretty face. She's definitely been a person of substance and has, been public with her activism. And so I think she could be a tremendous asset for him on the campaign trail. And that's the benefit of not being alone on the campaign trail, not being a single person. Not only is it just sort of a kind of completes the picture for people, but it really does doubles your money.
Yeah.
That's one thing I think that the spouse does so incredibly, that's an incredibly important role the spouse plays, is the candidate's time is limited. And this way you essentially have a proxy who can get out there and fundraise and work on behalf of the candidate. So you're effectively, and in a way that no other, proxy for the campaign could, no other surrogate can function in the role of a spouse or partner. And so that's what she brings.
Tammy Vigil, I was thinking back to the first gubernatorial term of Jerry Brown here in California. He was single. He was dating Linda Ronstadt. And there was a lot of attention to that relationship with the very popular singer at the time, still influential figure in music. And it didn't seem California voters held that against him that he was single. I wonder, looking at a presidential race today, do you think that there is any price to pay for a candidate who's not married?
I don't think that there's actually a huge price to pay for an unmarried candidate. I think except for the fact that there is the possibility that they, as Emily so astutely pointed out, that they don't have the sort of partner to help them out and to sort of soften the edges. But what happens, especially with what we've been seeing with Cory Booker and what you've been describing with Brown, that their dating life sort of does that job
in a different kind of way. People become more interested in them, in their personalities and their personally based on who they're dating and those kinds of stories instead. So it's a different way of personalizing them, but they do lose out in the benefit of having a partner. And I just wanted to mention also, we keep sort of forgetting about Melania Trump and her sort of relative lack of activity in 2016. She was not out there campaigning on her own and doing the additional sort of fundraising things, and yet we still saw the candidate be successful in spite of that. So you don't have to have a partner or a very active partner to be a successful candidate. But it does make life a little bit more difficult, and it does make it it gives you less control over some of the narrative that goes on around you in your personal life as well.
The thing that I think is so different, though, is that, you know, Trump was a household name. Everybody felt like they had a sense of who he was and knew him. So many of the Democratic candidates, no one really knows who they are, and the spouse is a bit of a shorthand to sort of give a sense of who that person is. And I wonder if it's much more essential in that case, Tammy.
Well, I think it helps. But one of the things that is a bit of an issue right now altogether with such a big field, especially for the Democrats, they're just trying to get the attention to begin with and trying to become a household name. You sort of do need, it does help a lot if you have an additional partner to be out there raising your profile, which I think we see with the Buttigieg. Judges.
they actually, easy for you to say.
I know. Sorry. You think I'd have practiced many times.
We're all learning this as we go.
It's the pluralizing that's the problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is that the two of them together are creating a higher profile than one alone. And we see plenty of other folks whose spouses are not being very active that I don't think people can even name.
Tammy, I appreciate it. Tammy V. Hill, Lauren Wright, Emily Heil, joining us on Air Talk. More to come, second hour. Nelson Cade III was performing on guitar for patrons at a Westwood restaurant on Friday night when he had a note slipped to him mid-set that his musical idol was sitting in the audience having dinner and asked if he could come up and perform with Cade during the middle of his set. Stevie Wonder happened to be that patron at the Skylight Gardens restaurant in Westwood. Nelson Cade III joins us later this hour to share his story, what it was like for him to have that experience performing with a musical legend. And we'll open up the phones for you to share any experience you might have had similar. Now, maybe it wasn't a performance, but maybe it was words of encouragement, something that made a difference for you as you were taking a particular artistic route as a writer, as a musician, as an actor, director, whatever it is. I'd love to hear that encounter that you had with someone that you had idolized or at least admired and how that individual made a difference for you. But first, we turn our attention to the ride-hailing apps Uber and Lyft. Drivers today are taking part in a nationwide strike, and LAX is ground zero for the job action here in Southern California. Joining us is KPECC Business and Economy reporter David Wagner at LAX. David, share with us what you're seeing at the airport.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Here at the airport, there are a few dozen riders protesting at the departures level right now. I think maybe 100 total. There's not a ton of drivers out here when you think about all the thousands of drivers that are working in LA, but they're very noticeable. You know, they've got signs that say things like 60 cents per mile, not a living wage. They're here protesting a recent per-mile pay cut that L.A. drivers got from Uber. You know, signs that say stop stealing from drivers. And they're out here trying to get people to learn about the strike that's happening today, to get their support. You have some drivers driving by honking their horns in support. And they've been here since 5 a.m. They're planning to go all day.
And have there been any confrontations between the striking drivers and drivers working today as they drop off or pick up their passengers?
Well, that's one interesting thing that I've seen a lot here so far is you see a lot of cars with Uber and Lyft insignia on the windshield pulling up, dropping off passengers. So clearly, you know, we have drivers here that
have either chosen to not participate in the strike. Maybe they don't know about the strike. Maybe they're not plugged into the same kind of social media groups and channels that these drivers are. They're not involved with the organizations putting this together. And that does lead to these kind of confrontations where the protesters are sort of yelling at the drivers, you know, they're not paying you a living wage, don't work for free, we're striking just for one day. And I think that these kind of scenes of confrontation between the drivers who are striking and the drivers who are continuing to stay on the road, it really gets to how difficult organizing something like this can be.
And is there any indication of sort of who's organized the strike, anything on the signs? I mean, are they looking for unionization? What's going on?
Well, this is put together by a group called Rideshare Drivers United. They're based here in L.A., and they're working with groups around the country. There's other strikes and protests happening in cities throughout the U.S. They say they have 4,400 members who've chosen to turn their Uber and Lyft apps off for 24 hours today. You know, they're calling for better pay. They're calling for a Bill of Rights that includes more job, you know, protection and benefits and things like that.
All right, David, anything to add before I let you go so you can report for the rest of the day here on KPCC?
Well, I'll be here throughout the afternoon. They're heading to a bigger rally at noon, and we'll have more coverage later this afternoon.
All right. Thanks very much, KPCC reporter David Wagner, with us from LAX, which is the center of the job action today by some Uber and Lyft drivers. Also with us is Carolyn Saeed of the San Francisco Chronicle. She joins us regularly to talk about business and technology's intersection. Carolyn, good morning. Give us a little bit more background on this and specifically what the drivers are demanding.
Well, this is probably the biggest action there has been yet against Uber and Lyft, and it's pretty impressive considering what a disparate and scattered workforce they are. And it is true, though, I think, as David said, that the percentage of drivers participating is fairly small compared to the hundreds of thousands of drivers out there. So drivers in about a dozen U.S. cities and several cities and overseas are protesting basically over pay and working conditions. The specific demands and the specific times of blacking out on the app vary from city to city. But basically, it all comes down to they feel they don't make enough money. The shares that Uber and Lyft take over are increasing and increasing. And as those companies go public, they need to take even more money from the drivers if they ever have a hope of making a profit. And that doesn't work for the drivers.
Speaking of that initial public offering, the Wall Street Journal just now reporting, according to their sources, Uber Technologies on track to price its initial public offering at the midpoint of its target or below, that after the big stock market drop and the disappointing debut of Lyft. Uber, of course, according to the journal, is looking to launch this IPO set to price today ahead of tomorrow's trading debut. And Carolyn, I assume that this job action is timed to the launch of the IPO.
Of course. The drivers are very well aware that the eyes of the world are on Uber with its debut this week. And so they timed their actions to coincide. And you know, really, it's brilliant when you think about it. If you look on Twitter, if you look, if you just Google Uber Lyft strike, you will find dozens and dozens and dozens of articles in all major media outlets. So they have gotten a tremendous amount of attention. And I think that's actually what they're trying to accomplish. I don't think Uber and Lyft are necessarily going to come out and say, oh, yeah, we're going to raise your rates. But they're getting a lot of attention. They're getting political attention. Bernie Sanders has been tweeting his support consistently for several days now. And as you probably know, in California, the legislature is weighing AB 5, which is would codify an existing Supreme Court decision making more gig workers become employees, example A being Uber and Lyft drivers. So I think the legislators have to be aware of this, too.
I wonder about the competitive advantage on price that Uber and Lyft enjoy and how much higher the platforms can go in compensating drivers and not have to raise fares to the point where it's not competitive with taxis. And Carolyn, has there been an analysis of that to try and determine how much sort of headroom on fares that there is to keep the platforms competitive?
Well, we've only just gotten a peek into their finances when with their public filings, because up till now they've been private companies. But basically, for the years and years that Uber and Lyft have been in operation, all those cheap fares to the airport have been subsidized by the venture capitalists and other investors who poured billions of dollars into them. So their basic plan is to make fares as cheap as possible and make themselves indispensable. And if that results in driving taxis out of business, then they would no longer have competitors and they could raise fares.
Lucille, making that very point on our AirTalk page, she says, here's what's going to happen. Taxis are expensive. Once Uber and Lyft eliminate the taxi industry, they'll raise their prices slowly but surely until they're no cheaper than taxis were, and we're no better off than before. That's Lucille writing on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Also with us, Harry Campbell, who's the LA-based Uber and Lyft driver and founder of the RideshareGuide.com, the blog and podcast that is targeted for rideshare drivers. Harry, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me back on, Larry.
So it sounds like, you know, most drivers are still working today, not taking part in the job action. Nonetheless, there are a fair number of drivers that are out there, you know, protesting, attending rallies. What do you think is the best possible outcome here for drivers?
Yeah, you know, I think that there are over 50,000 rideshare drivers in Los Angeles. And so when you look at the percentages, it is going to be small. But I think a better baseline might be past strikes and past efforts, because Uber and Lyft have cut rates many times over the years. And there's typically some sort of strike or there is some sort of organization effort. But it really wasn't until the most recent strike, when Uber lowered the per mile rate by 25% just about a month and a half ago. And we saw the first strike at LAX, where there was at least a few hundred drivers, or sorry, not at LAX, but at the Uber Greenlight Center, which is a support center for drivers. We saw a few hundred drivers there, and that was probably one of the most impressive turnouts I've seen. And from the various protests that are happening today, it seems like there's already bigger numbers than that. And I suspect the noon rally over at LAX today will have even more drivers.
Love to hear from drivers today, whether you're out on the road looking for fares or whether you're taking part in the job action. Maybe you're heading to one of the locations. You have a moment to join us and share your thoughts about what you think of the job action, whether you think there will be a payoff for drivers. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Uber provided AirTalk with a statement this morning saying, drivers are at the heart of our service. We can't succeed without them. And thousands of people come into work at Uber every day focused on how to make their experience better on and off the road. Whether it's more consistent earnings, stronger insurance protections, or fully funded four-year degrees for drivers or their families, we'll continue working to improve the experience for and with drivers. That's Uber's statement. Lyft provided AirTalk with this statement. Lyft drivers' hourly earnings have increased 7% over the last 2 years, and they have earned more than $14 billion since we launched. Over 75% drive less than 10 hours a week to supplement existing jobs. On average, Lyft drivers earn over $20 an hour. We know that access to flexible extra income makes a big difference for millions of people, and we're constantly working to improve how we can best serve our driver community. That's Lyft statement. Harry, what did Uber say in justifying the 25% decrease in per mile compensation?
So I think what they said in their email to drivers was essentially that these were the rates that they used to have. So all the way back in September of last year, they had certain rates, and then they rebalanced those rates. So they actually decreased the per mile and increased the per time, the per minute rate, and then they went back to the original pricing, is what they're telling drivers. And so you can sort of see that it's been a pretty confusing journey as far as rates, right, with a lot of different changes. But for the most part, I think it is clear that this was a rate cut that Uber instituted. And I think the tough part for drivers is that you go to log on the app one day and you see that the per mile rate is cut by 25%. And Uber said that these rates didn't work out. And I guess my question was, who didn't it work out for? Because drivers were making more money. And so it kind of just seemed like a little bit of tone deaf messaging that, hey, we don't want drivers to make more money. This didn't work out. We're going to revert back to the old rates.
Robert near USC says, I drive for Uber. I've felt that shift in pay. Makes me not want to drive anymore. It's just not worth it, especially with the price of gas going up. And Harry, we hear these stories about drivers, once they paid their expenses, coming away with little to show for it. But nonetheless, they continue to drive, either because they have other jobs that, you know, this is supplementary to, or they're just simply nothing better and they're taking the little bit that they get for driving. But what's your sense of how much room these ride-hailing companies have to increase compensation but still be viable for riders?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I know you asked about taxi rates earlier, which we can definitely get into. But I mean, I think that one of the misconceptions I see out there often is that Uber and Lyft are the ones who set prices. Over the past 5 years, you know, sort of like David commented, both companies have actually lowered rates. It's now cheaper than ever to take an Uber. If you took Uber 5 years ago in LA, you probably remember that it was much more expensive than it is today. And so what that means for drivers is that they're now getting paid less than ever, and they are responsible for their expenses. So gas has been going up, for example, a lot of stories about that. Rates haven't gone up to reflect that. So drivers are actually making less just because of the gas increase. And I think as far as the actual margins a company is making, you know, in their S1s that Uber and Lyft released, they said they were losing money on every single ride, but I feel like they are losing money because they've lowered rates so low. It's sort of by their choice, right? I don't know that it's necessarily they can't raise rates. Right now in LA, to give you an example, they pay 60 cents per mile. And I'm looking at the taxi rates right now in LA, and there's a little bit different pricing, but their per mile rate is $2.70. So it's almost four times higher at the per mile rate.
We're talking with Harry joining us regularly to talk about Uber and Lyft. He's a driver for both of the ride hailing companies, and Harry Campbell is the founder of the RideshareGuy.com. Carolyn Saeed of the San Francisco Chronicle with us as well. And again, I'd love to hear if you drive for Uber or Lyft, whether you're taking part in the job action today or not. I'd like to hear your thoughts about what you see as the future of these platforms, what you'd like to see in the way of compensation. 866-893-KPCC. Marcos in Pasadena says, I'm a Lyft driver and I don't want to work for a union. I want to work for myself. Don't unionize drivers. We'll come back, hear what others, if you have to say about it, in 1 minute. We're talking about Uber and Lyft drivers, the challenge they're having making a living driving for the services and what the demands are for the company and additional compensation. Jim in Temecula, I understand you drive throughout the region. I have been doing it for over 4 years. What are your thoughts about the job action today?
Well, you know, I think we need to get our heads together, because when I started with Uber 4.5 years ago, and I have over 7,500 rides, and now I drive in Temecula, but I get called to LAX, and I get, you know, rides all over the Riverside County and San Diego County. But, you know, when they started out, they lured us in at $1.25 an hour, and that was pretty competitive for the amount of driving I do. I was making $1,000 a week. But
you mean per mile, right? Not hour.
I meant per mile.
Yeah.
You know, but gradually they start taking back and charging service fees to the customers that the driver doesn't get. It goes right to Uber. So when they say they're taking 25%, they're taking close to 40, 50, 60% in some cases. So, you know, the way I look at it is, and it's been just cash flow for me because it's not profitable. But in LA, the drivers are exposed to a lot of danger and risk. I mean, we all know what it's like driving on freeways in L.A. It's crazy. And to take that kind of risk on at 60 cents a mile when 57 cents is tax allowable deduction by the IRS, how is it beneficial to a driver to drive for 3 cents a mile and have that kind of exposure and liability and risk.
So are you looking at stopping to drive for the platforms?
Well, I have alternatives. I trade stocks in the morning, so I make a good living doing that. I'm actually retired, but it's just gotten to the point where it's like, why even bother?
Yeah.
I just don't want to take the risk and liability. It's risk and liability for the small amount of money. Now, one of the previous callers mentioned, not joining the union or a union, but how do you control companies that take advantage of their employees unless you get together and unify as a group? The strike, I think, is sending a message, but as you mentioned earlier, and I heard in the broadcast, not all drivers are participating. Some are all still driving.
Yeah.
So we got to get our heads together and come together as a unified group, both Lyft and Uber, and send a signal to these companies that we're not going to take it anymore. We're not going to accept 3 cents a mile or less. Will work for nothing.
Jim, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much. Jim in Temecula drives for Uber and has been doing so for 4.5 years. Let me go back to San Francisco Chronicle reporter Carolyn Saeed. And, how far are those trying to get a union organized here? How far are they making inroads?
Well, under U.S. labor law, non-employees cannot form a union, unfortunately. So there are sort of union-like organizations they can form. In New York, there's the New York Drivers – I'm not saying the name correctly – something like the New York Drivers Alliance. It has some union components. It has some buy-in from Uber. If the workers were to become employees, of course, then they would have the right to unionize. And many of these actions, the informal drivers groups are getting input, advice, and assistance from organized labor, which would love to help organized Uber and Lyft drivers.
Carolyn, I know you have to leave, but are you going to the San Francisco rally at Uber headquarters?
That's exactly why I have to leave at
okay.
The San Francisco drivers. Here we are in ground zero of Uber. At noon, the San Francisco drivers will be rallying outside Uber's headquarters in our mid-market area, and should be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you aware of any attrition of drivers since Uber made this per-mile cut?
It's really hard to say because we don't have visibility into it, and they have a tremendous amount of turnover anyway. They always have, some huge percentage of drivers drive for less than a year. And part of that is the nature of the work. Many people just do it to fill in when they're in between jobs or when they're in school or during the summer. I know teachers who do it during the summer, because we don't pay our teachers enough in this country. And so there already is a tremendous amount of turnover. How much that's increased, it's hard to say, and whether at some point they'll tap out and they won't be able to be attracting as many new drivers as they need to make up for the ones who leave, also hard to say. But
all right, Carolyn, thanks so much. We appreciate it, and ride safely to the Uber headquarters. Carolyn Saeed, business and technology reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, frequent guest with us. Also, Harry Campbell, the rideshare guy, Uber and Lyft driver. Harry, I was wondering about, Carolyn mentioning the different constituencies within the driver community. Does that make it difficult when you've got people that are, like full-time drivers, this is their bread and butter income, versus those doing it on the side around other jobs? Are their goals hugely different, expectations different? Does it make it harder for everybody to come together?
Yeah, I think it definitely, for two reasons, it makes it difficult. In the first sense, you've got a bunch of full-time drivers, and you also have a lot of part-time drivers. So the full-time drivers that are already working 40 to 50 hours a week and not getting any of the benefits, not getting any of the health insurance, they're typically the ones who are sort of pushing to become employees, since they're working like employees but without any of the benefits. And where we've seen some of the most progress in organization and actual legislation being passed is in places like New York City, where there's a very high number of full-time drivers because there's much more stricter requirements. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense to be a part-time driver. But secondarily, I do think that one of the, when I'm looking at the Bill of Rights that the Rideshare Drivers United organization group here in LA is demanding, they're actually, two of their main points are fair pay, so higher pay and a capped commission. One of the callers earlier talked about the 40, the 50, the 60% commission that Uber and Lyft sometimes take on fares. And these are two items items that, you know, whether you're full-time or part-time, you probably want to be paid more. You also probably want Uber and Lyft's commission to be capped. And, you know, when I look at the Bill of Rights, I don't see anything about them pushing for a union. So I think in that sense, they've done a good job so far listening to drivers and sort of figuring out, hey, you know, regardless of whether you're full-time or part-time, what are the things that we can all agree on?
All right. We're talking with Harry Campbell, Uber and Lyft driver and founder of the RideshareGuy.com. Harry, are drivers concerned that the more that they push higher compensation, that the more quickly we may get to autonomous vehicles? Or they're feeling like, well, that's going to happen, you know, whether it does or not, independent of the labor costs for Uber?
You know, I think that drivers are actually quite removed and disconnected from a lot of the company-wide initiatives that Uber and Lyft may be pushing, whether it's autonomous vehicles or the IPO. And, you know, drivers are talking to me and asking me questions about these stories, but it really doesn't affect their day-to-day lives as a driver. And so I think that for the most part, you know, if you ask drivers, I sometimes joke that, you know, you don't want to give drivers complete control. If you let drivers set the rates, they would probably price themselves out of the market. But at the same time, up until this point, Uber and Lyft have had 100% control over rates. And so I think that it's gone too far in that direction. And a good starting place is at least listening to drivers and listening to their demands and see what they're asking for. And let's start finding some middle ground to kind of at least balance the scales a bit.
All right. Let's talk with Jeff in Hancock Park. I understand you drive part-time for Uber. Your thoughts about the job action today?
Well, I do it part-time because I'm also a real estate agent, which helps me, you know, stay up to date with the market, and I pick up clients this way. I actually don't like it if they become an employee, because then really what it is you have about 4 million drivers throughout the U.S. or so. It's really about the government not getting the money. So when you're independent, you can be able to hold on to that money and, you know, pay your bills when you need it. And then, you know, when you pay your taxes, write off everything. So, you know, it's having that money up front and when you need it. But when the gentleman was just talking about autonomous drivers, I mean, it's going to happen within 3 to 5 years. It's down the road and it's going to happen. So for people who do this full time, they need it. It shouldn't be full time. It needs to be where they have another job. This is giving them extra income, because if they are doing this full time, when it turns into that, they're going to be out of luck.
Yeah, I don't know about realistically 3 to 5 years. That'd be pretty quick to get an autonomous fleet out there. But Jeff, I appreciate your sharing your thoughts about this. 866-893-KPCC. Jonathan, in Reseda, what do you want to see come out of this job action? I understand you're a full-time Uber driver.
Yeah, Larry, thank you. Hey, you know, the rate cut that they put us on requires that I work 30% more to make the same amount of money. Okay, the time that we spend in the car, 8 to 10 hours a day, is, you know, it's a long day, and now they're trying to push us into 12-hour days, and, you know, I think that's a little bit unfair. To make the same amount of money, I'm working a third more. The rate cut hurt a lot.
Are you making any of that up with the in-app tipping? Has that raised the gratuities that you're getting?
Actually, I get some good tips sometimes, but a lot of people don't tip. Usually, you know, longer rides, they tip okay, but most people only tip a dollar, maybe two, and I'm grateful for that, all right, because that does help. With what's been going on, I've noticed I've been getting more tips, though. With the word getting out, people are actually paying me more to ride with them.
All right. Jonathan, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Let me share another call. This comes from Edmund in Glendale. Says, I drove a taxi for 25 years. I think what Uber drivers must be happy with is they don't have to pay a rental fee. I used to pay $580 a month, whether I worked or not. They don't have that burden. But at the same time, 60 cents a mile is very low. Should be at least a dollar a mile. Harry Campbell, your response to Edmund, former taxi driver's point.
Yeah, you know, I think Edmund hit the nail on the head that the system we have now with Uber, I think, is much preferable for drivers. Instead of having to do a weekly rental fee, drivers can now use their own car and it's a lot more flexible. But at the same time, you know, the prices are 75% lower at the per mile rate compared to taxis. So you can say what you want about taxis, but I do think at the end of the day, taxis and Uber and Lyft are really providing the exact same service these days. And, you know, I think that's why we're seeing, especially in other cities like New York, we have the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. They're organizing with the IDG, which is the Independent Drivers Guild, which is the one that represents Uber and Lyft drivers. So a lot of these drivers, you know, at one point they were on opposite sides, and it seems like they're actually coming together now.
Harry, thank you as always. I so appreciate your providing the drivers' perspectives. I put that multiple because I know not everybody agrees within the driving definitely community, and I appreciate you sharing the different points of view. Thanks so much.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
Harry Campbell, LA-based Uber and Lyft driver. He's the founder of the RideshareGuy.com, a blog and podcast for rideshare drivers. My thanks to Carolyn Saeed of the San Francisco Chronicle. And you'll hear KPCC reporter David Wagner's ongoing reports throughout the day from LAX, where that strike and job action taking place with signs, noisemakers and the like as people are arriving at LAX. Coming up, we'll talk about the experience of an Angelino who's a musician. He's playing his guitar at a gig in Westwood on Friday night, only to get word that his musical icon is sitting in the audience having dinner and asks if he can join him in performance. An extraordinary experience. We'll talk with that musician coming up, but I want to hear if you've had something at all similar where your icon has intersected with you in person, shared either a word or encouragement or complimented you on what you did, or even in some way performed with you. What was that experience like? We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle as we listen to the hit song Superstition from the great singer-songwriter Stevie Wonder, who happened to be in the audience at the Westwood restaurant Skylight Gardens Friday night listening to guitarist Nelson Cade III. Cade, as he was performing, was slipped a note that Mr. Wonder was in the audience and that he would love to come up and perform with him. So here from Nelson Cade III's Instagram, Stevie Wonder performing along with Cade at Skylight Gardens.
No, I'm following you. I'm following you outside.
Yes, that's Stevie Wonder performing with Nelson Cade III last Friday night. And Nelson joining us. Good morning. Thanks for coming in and sharing this experience.
Ooh, good morning. Thank you for having me, Larry. This is amazing.
I imagine your life's been a whirlwind in the few days since this happened. Now, Wonder actually came to the restaurant with, he had this little steel guitar-like instrument. I've heard him play it before, so it sounds like he was ready to go.
So that was the most amazing thing. It was him and his wife. They were sitting down enjoying their meal. I did not recognize that instrument when I first saw it. Afterwards, I was racking my brain, and I found out that it's actually a harpeggi. They're really cool. I think they have 14-plus strings, and they're very, very, very fun to play. I'm actually considering getting one now.
Yeah. So did you spot him at all in the audience?
I did not. When he first walked in the restaurant, I'm about an hour and a half into my set, so I'm in the zone. My eyes are closed. I could be, anything could happen around me, and I'd be completely unaware. I'm just in the music. And Sean, the bartender, is the one who walked by mid-song. And I mean, I open my eyes, I see him approaching me. He drops off a note. So I'm in mid-song, and I just kind of look down, and it says, Stevie Wonder is here. And I'm trying not to break tone because, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that had to be nerve-wracking. Is this a regular gig for you?
Yes, it is. I'm there just about every Friday night from 7 to 10.
So to have this happen and then him want to get up and perform with you, was that both terrifying and exciting?
Yeah, I think it is the purest definition of the word exhilarating. It was amazing. I mean, it started off intimidating. It was a kind of intimidating that I've never felt so sudden. And I would say about 30 seconds in, maybe a minute into us playing, I just felt so familiar. I mean, I felt like I was just jamming in my living room with my best friend because he made me feel so comfortable.
So about a half hour, you two performed again. What did he say to you after that experience?
He said, thank you. He thanked me. We shook hands and everything. I gave him a lot of, time to go meet with the crowd, take all the pictures and all that. I didn't want to, rush him afterwards. I want to make sure he's comfortable. He was there with his wife and everything. But afterwards, we sat down and we talked, and he was curious about if I wrote music. I told him I do. He says, where can I find it? And I was telling him that I'm in the middle of making, professional quality product. So that will be coming out hopefully the end of summer. That's my deadline. And he said, I'm excited to hear your music. I can't wait for your EP to come out.
So you attended the Orange County School for the Performing Arts, I understand.
Yes,
so
I did.
You've been a musician growing up, and here you are in your mid-20s now and still doing regular gigs. And you have, like most musicians in town, you have a day job, too.
Absolutely. I started piano in, first grade. I was 5, maybe 6 years old, and I completely hated the instrument when I first started. Oh, yes. I remember there was a young man at South Bay Junior Academy. That's the school I was attending at the time. This young man, he would play piano. And because he could play piano, all of the students could assemble for, mass, if you will. We had, a chapel every Friday, and we would sing songs. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. I was in first grade. So I'm thinking, I don't have to be in class for, 20 minutes just because this one kid can do this for us. So I wanted to do that. I remember going and asking my parents for piano lessons, and they said, sure, we'll get you piano lessons, but if you start, you're not allowed to stop. I'm 6. I don't know what commitment is. I'm like, sure, let's go, whatever. And about 3 years into it, I finally started falling in love with the instrument.
And you're performing today. Do you only play guitar? You play piano, too?
I play piano as well. I play guitar, and I sing.
All right. We're talking with Nelson Cade III, Southern California musician who, so many, plays gigs where you can get them. He has a regular one at the Skylight Gardens in Westwood, but a giant of music, about as giant as you can get, shows up on Friday night and asks to join him in performance. They perform for a little over half an hour. My question for you is, maybe your story isn't quite that dramatic as what Nelson has to share with Stevie, but maybe you have something where your life intersected with someone who was an idol in the field that you either work in or aspired to, and she or he was very important in inspiring you, or maybe actually worked with you later on. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Gina in Irvine, your experience where someone, a giant in a field, inspired you.
I met Georgia O'Keeffe at my college. She was invited by one of the professors, and it was not noted in the campus news. It was supposed
She showed up, Georgia O'Keeffe?
Yeah, and so she was in the studio. She was losing her eyesight and was going into ceramics, and that studio was ceramics. And I was a sophomore, and she was there around lunchtime, and no one was supposed to be there, so it would be secret. But I walked in, and Georgia was holding my pottery. It was at my area of shelving, and she was talking to Paul, the professor, about the shape and the texture, and I just melted. It was like, this is the most amazing thing. This is Georgia O'Keeffe.
Now, did you go on and continue to make pottery or do something in the arts?
I did for a while, and then I couldn't make a living.
Yeah, familiar story. So how many times, I have to ask, have you told the Georgia O'Keeffe story, Gina?
Not very many times.
Really? Gosh, I think I'd be telling that story time and again to new people, hopefully to new people, not the same people over. Gina, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Probably, well, I have two experiences, probably nothing as dramatic as Nelson's. When I was in college and I was doing our college basketball games for the student radio station, the Lakers had an opening for their color announcer. And I sent a letter to Chick Hearn, the longtime Laker announcers, you know, very famous. I admired him so much. And, you know, here I am, some college kid. I sent him a letter asking if I can audition to be the color announcer for the Lakers. He sent me back the nicest handwritten letter. It's like a page long. Larry, I wish you the very best in your career. You know, we're hiring Pat Riley, who went on to be the Lakers. Pat Riley is going to be our new color announcer. I have to find this letter somewhere from Chick Hearn. But I wish you all the best. I'm sure you'll be a great success in broadcasting. And it was just very, very nice. And then years later, once I'd started Air Talk, I was doing the program. We were doing it live from the Democratic National Convention at the LA Convention Center. And Michael Jackson, the talk show host on KBC for many years, who I'd grown up listening to and admired his work so much, was just at the table next to me. We got there the earliest of anybody to work on our shows. He actually beat me there, which is tough because I was in early. And he came up to me as I was sitting there preparing, and he said, "I hate you." And I said, you know, here's my idol saying, "I hate you." And I said, "Oh," he said, my sons listen to you all the time and are constantly telling me what a great show you have. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't quite know what to say to Michael Jackson, but he smiled and he said, "No, I hear your work and I just appreciate what you do so much." It was very nice. And it opened up the door to further conversations with Michael Jackson over the years, including him guest hosting for me at some point here on Air Talk on the program. So I'd love to hear your experience. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation in just 1 minute.
Living just enough for the city.
Pretty hard to pick a favorite Stevie song, but that may be it for me. So many gems, music, idol, icon, culturally in the United States. Stevie Wonder showing up Friday night at a Westwood restaurant where our guest Nelson Cade III was performing on guitar. And Stevie Wonder asked if he'd come up and perform with him. And a half hour later, they'd done a spontaneous set together. We're talking about some of the great experiences listeners have had with their idols, iconic figures who might have encouraged them or even ended up performing them. Let's talk with Fritz in Marina Del Rey, who had an encounter with one of my all-time favorites. Fritz, go right ahead. Tell your story.
Hey, so what, you remember Dante? You Dante's in North Hollywood.
Hey, Fritz, we got to get your audio quality cleaned up. Yes, I remember Dante's in Universal City, a great jazz club. I would go there whenever I could afford to cover the charge to go in. But Fritz, I want to get you on the air because you have a great story to share. Let's talk with Dave in Glendale. What's your experience?
Hey, I was touring with Melissa Etheridge. I'm a professional drummer known as the Groove Doctor. And I was touring with Melissa Etheridge for most of the 90s, and we opened for Sting. And he was the only one that came in and thanked us for being there and for opening for him. He's a super nice man, and I got to talk with him for a while about music, and it was just life-changing.
It's great. I've also had very nice conversations with Sting, and I would second what you say, Dave. Yeah, great to talk with him. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Dave, what is there something specifically he said that really spoke to you as a musician?
Oh, absolutely. He said, because I talked to him about the idea that he's taking jazz musicians, because it was the 10 Sumner's Tales album that he was touring on.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "What's it like playing with jazz players that are used to playing 5 and 10 minute solos each?" and they got to do it in 8 or 16 measures, you know? And he said, well, that's the beauty of it. They have to tell the same story in, you know, 1/10 of the time. Yeah. And I just, that really stuck with me.
Dave, hey, I appreciate it so much. Thanks. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Again, what sort of inspiring message or performance or collaboration did you end up doing with someone who was iconic for you? 866-893-KPCC. Kelly in Glendale, what was your experience?
Well, while I was in college, the arts were really popular and what have you, and I was studying theater and child psychology and family studies, and I had a television show on public access at KPBS in San Diego.
Yeah.
And Mr. Fred Rogers came out to look at the new facility that we were building next to the campus for KPBS at San Diego State University. And I got to meet him because he went to my set, which was a preschool show called It's Cook Kelly Time. And he said hello to every child that was on my show, every parent that was on my show. It was as if he had already been there for months and months and months, and he was part of the show.
Wow.
He was such a nice guy and so willing to sit back and watch what we were doing and ask how we were doing it. And, you know, because his programming was for family studies as well, I felt like kin with him. And it was very inspirational because I went on after college and I became a producer and director in animation and worked for the Jim Henson Productions.
Wow.
And then I also wound up teaching middle school, high school, and college. And in middle school and high school, I taught a public access television show for middle schoolers and high schools at the Pasadena Media Center.
Yeah, sure.
In Pasadena.
Oh, Kelly, what a great story. Fred Rogers, I guess no surprise that he would be such an inspirational figure. Fritz in Marina Del Rey was starting to tell us about he was playing a gig at the great, late-lamented Dante's Jazz Club in Universal City. So, Fritz, who showed up?
So, I'm sitting at, I go to the bar to get something, and this latest comes and sits down, and she starts talking to me, you know, but she's kind of animated, and I'm like, okay, this is a black lady in a bar full of white guys. I'm like, okay, let me leave because something's going to happen. And I will go to my man. I tell him, I say, hey, man, you see her? She's going to get in trouble. So we go on the stage to play Blue Mitchell. I'm playing with Blue Mitchell. And her.
Oh, wow, you're playing with Blue Mitchell? Wow. Great.
Yeah, so he comes up after we play the tune. He says, we have a guest in the audience, and we'd like for the asses to come up and sing. He says, Sarah Vaughan. I'm like, oh, Sarah Vaughan, where is she? So the crowd parts like the ocean, like the Red Sea. And that same lady who I had kind of blown off, snubbed off, she comes up to the stage, and she's looking at me like, uh-huh, you didn't know, did you? And she counts the tune off and we start playing and she turns around and throws me a kiss.
She was known as Sassy, as you know, Fritz. And yeah, it sounds like she was in a very good mood that night and an extraordinary singer. Just one of the greatest voices of all time. Sarah Vaughan, incomparable.
For sure.
Yeah. So, Fritz, what a great story to share. Thank you. I appreciate you sharing that experience. Angelo in West Hollywood says, I was playing a gig at a restaurant in the Valley. In the middle of a song, someone was singing along with me. It was Al Jarreau singing from his seat. Wow. And thought, Angelo, wow, what another great experience. Stephen in Beverly Hills, I was working at the staff canteen in the basement of the Greek Theater. Joni Mitchell was opening. Pre-concert, I saw her practicing her piano. She's just a young pianist, and it's been a lifelong inspiration just seeing her there as she was practicing to prepare to go out as the opening act at the Greek. Gabriel in Highland Park said, I ended up playing with T-Pain. I was playing a YouTube mashup cover, and he was singing his own medley. I was singing, playing violin. They didn't put my name on the video, but it ended up going viral. I was discovered on Reddit, and it sure helped me out. That's Gabriel in Highland Park. Hey, Nelson Cade III, thank you for sharing this experience that you had with Stevie Wonder Friday night.
Oh, absolutely. This has been a dream. It's amazing.
Yeah, and great to know you don't have to worry about waking up and it was a dream. This really happened.
Right.
You've got the audio documentation of it now.
Oh, goodness.
Hey,
I'm
thanks.
I'm forever grateful.
Thanks, and all the best with your musical career. We know this can only be beneficial in getting even greater exposure, which any talented musician can appreciate. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. You have
thank
a good
you.
One.
Thanks very much. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Have a great day from all of us at Air Talk.